Hello, everybody, and welcome to Right Wing Dharma Squad's episode 9 on anger. I am your host, Dharma Kirti, joined by some friends.
Hello, it's Aura again.
And I'm Kagyu.
Unfortunately, Storm King couldn't make it. He was teaching the poor, poor people who follow Pure Land Buddhism in Sukhavati, the Pure Land of Amitabha. He's instructing them on Zen, which is, you know, I'm sure it'll be a great benefit to all involved. He should be back with us next week. In the meantime, we have a special guest who you may have heard on my appearance in the cocktail hour a little while ago. But anyway, hopefully he won't make too much of a ruckus. As we put in the title, the topic today is anger, which I think, you know, it's a timely topic for a lot of reasons. There's a lot going around, and I have some things that I would like to say and some points that I would like to make. But first, if it's okay by you, Kagyu, I think that we have a really good thing going on with letting Aura take it away first, and I really have enjoyed the things that he has said so far. So, Aura, if you and you mentioned that you have a little bit that you'd like to do. So, without any further ado,
I like the way you check with Kagyu if it's if you do that rather than checking with me if that's okay.
But it's absolutely fine, of course, and because he's right.
Yeah, man, sure. I don't have anything like very specific prepared, but what I did write down at the very beginning, you know, what we've done before is just talk about the sort of the bare bones of it. And when we talk about anger, I think the first question that comes up in is, as Buddhists, is anger a good thing? And I guess I get my soapbox right at the beginning here, and I want to be very clear. That the Buddha's answer is very clear. The answer is no. It's not okay. It's not good. It's one of the hindrances. It's one of the core hindrances or defilements, the kleshas. You know, there's a million different ways that gets translated. We'll leave some wiggle room here to have a good discussion about why does it come up and can it be transformed into something more useful or whatever. But in and of itself, anger is something to be not necessarily avoided, but something to be conquered, something to be killed. In fact, there's a sutra where they talk about killing anger, which is an interesting way to put it. In fact, I have a little bit here from the sutras. This is from Pali, an English translation by Thanissara Book of the Kodana Sutra, about an angry person. And it's long, I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but the Buddha basically lists 7 ways in which an enemy might want to harm his enemy, like different ways you could harm your enemy, and points out that if you made your enemy angry, then this would be the way to create those things. So you can make your enemy uglier. You can make him have poor sleep. You could make your enemy lose money, lose reputation, lose friendships and everything. And all of these things could be achieved through anger. So when you become angry and when you let anger dominate you, you're doing what your enemy would want to be done to you. Like you're doing your enemy's work for him by becoming angry. And it ends with a little verse, only the first part of which I'll read here, which is, an angry person is ugly and sleeps poorly. Gaining a profit, he turns it into a loss, having done damage with word and deed. A person overwhelmed with anger destroys his wealth. Maddened with anger, he destroys his status. Relatives, friends, and colleagues avoid him. Anger brings loss. Anger inflames the mind. He doesn't realize that his danger is born from within. An angry person doesn't know his own benefit. An angry person doesn't see the Dharma. And it goes on, and the whole thing is quite good. But so there's my unambiguous answer at the very beginning. You know, how does Buddhism deal with anger in general? That's what I put it. But as I said at my very start, I think obviously there's a lot of room for nuance. And the word anger in English, of course, isn't a perfect translation and has different meanings. And I saw that you put in your tweet, Dharmakirti, about wrath, about hate, and there's other ways to look at it. So there's my intro, and I'll cede the floor.
Yeah, thank you for that. That was perfect. And we also have a very good addition already from the chat. Buddha Linkola notes that the Buddha says, holding on to anger is like grasping a hot coal with the intent of throwing it at someone else. You are the one who gets burned. And that is absolutely true. That is a very important quote. That is a very important concept. And I think one of the reasons why one of the main reasons why I wanted to talk about this is because it's not, how to say, in this thing, right, there's a kind of, there's a saying that goes around sometimes, which I don't even completely agree with, but it needs to be don't completely disagree with, but it really needs to be very carefully understood, very carefully qualified, which is that hate is your soul's immune system. I've seen that floating around, especially recently. And I think there's a very particular sense in which that's true. And to an extent, I think it needs, like, that's what I would call wrath, or in particular Vajra wrath, which is the term that I put in the blast out, and it's something that I'll get back to in a second. But that can be very easily misunderstood. And I think not only can it be very easily misunderstood, I think that for basically everyone who's repeating this quote or thinking about it in those terms, that they're thinking about it wrong, that they're actually just angry. And they're angry for understandable reasons. Anger is an understandable, it's not even something that needs to be justified. It just is. And it's, the issue really is how to manage it. It's much easier to manage than to prevent it from arising in the first place. Not impossible, but, and at a certain level, that's the goal, is we want to prevent anger, that kind of anger, the desire to hurt. I mean, that's really where I'm going with this, is anger in the way I'm using the word, and the way that this kind of hot coal thing, it's a desire to harm. It's a desire to hurt. It's a malicious. Yeah. It's a malicious desire. And that is what we need to be very carefully on guard against. But the one of the problems, or one of the sort of systemic structural problems that we have in clown world is, it's so difficult. It's structurally impossible for people to react negatively to almost anything. But in particular, when someone says, like, white people need to be, white people suck and all the litany thing, I don't need to go over them. But, when people start bashing white people and do the anti-straight white male thing, and all this hatred is directed at you, it is perfectly natural and perfectly normal, and to a point, or in a certain way, appropriate and correct to respond vigorously, energetically, not just passively kind of taking it, right? That is the right thing to do in a certain way. But the trap that we fall into, and one of the main reasons why I started doing this in the first place, I mean, maybe putting on airs for myself, but it was really like coming up in the past, I want to be a conscience for this movement to some extent, not in the sense of like, just in the sense of being like, look, it's not going to help us to just attack other people. I don't even mean like, the Kiwi Farms thing or anything like that. I really just mean like holding hatred in your heart for whoever is not going to help you. And it really isn't. I understand why we have these feelings of anger. I'm not saying they're not coming from anywhere understandable or justifiable. I'm just saying, if we want a way out, if we want to solve our problems and fix our society and build a sustainable future, anger and hatred, I'm sorry, it's just not going to help us.
And that's actually a very interesting point when you're talking about anger and how it's a danger. In a way, it almost seems like the mirror image of compassion. It's in the common understanding of it among people here in clown world, it's almost like the pathological altruism that people understand to be compassion. It's this highly attached, very samsaric, if you will, attachment to negative thoughts, to negative actions. And when the goal is to try and eliminate or reduce all attachments, that kind of anger, you can see very clearly how negative it is for oneself. The interesting thing, though, that I wanted to bring up, and I'm sure you have a lot to say about this, is, well, I mean, I guess maybe the Theravada tradition is unambiguous about how any sort of anger whatsoever is bad. At least in the Tibetan tradition, it seems like with the practice of Dharmapalas, Dharma protectors, which are embodiments of wrathful compassion, it almost seems like there is actually kind of a mirror image to the Buddhist understanding of compassion, where there's a kind of wrath that's similarly unattached to the sort of without the attachments that you see with like the pathological altruistic version of compassion. And that's something that actually isn't seen as unambiguously bad. Now, admittedly, I don't actually have any Dharmapala practice of my own under my belt, but that's just my understanding of it.
That's actually your understanding is I would say correct. And I mean, you know, to whatever extent you want to take my say so, but it's not entirely clear. I don't know if it's really unclear to anyone how much of the Tibetan thing, Tibetan Buddhism is basically a wholesale kind of like they just imported everything from India, or at least a snapshot of Indian Buddhism from around the time the Muslims came and killed everyone. I mean, it had been in Tibet before that happened for a couple centuries, but that's like when Tibet really became like a Dharma country in a lasting way and in the form up until the Chinese came and invaded. There was already in India before, like at the same time. So between like somewhere around 700, 800 at the latest, so probably also earlier, there was practices associated with what we call wrathful deities. And this is a basic division in Buddhism, and this definitely goes back to India, is between peaceful and wrathful deities. Now, a lot of this stuff got more systematized in Tibet and kind of expanded. So for example, there's a kind of famous book. I'm not a huge fan, and I'm certainly not a fan of the teacher, but Sogyal Rinpoche, who is now disgraced, wrote a book that was popular for a while called The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, which is a play on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is actually not a proper translation, but sort of Carl Jung, you know, famously thought that there was something going on in an important Tibetan text called the Bardo Tudrol, or the liberation upon hearing, and in the Bardo, the state between lives that you read to someone who is deceased, that you know, the idea is that their consciousness in some sense will be able to hear it and be liberated. And in that text is a description of, you know, like 50 something, forget the exact numbers, but it's basically like it's 108 peaceful and wrathful deities, and like there's a few more wrathful than peaceful. And that system, I don't know if it goes all the way back to India, not that it necessarily matters, but the point, sorry, I'm getting lost in the minutiae here. The point is the point is the peaceful and wrathful what we normally think of when we think of Buddhas probably is like these peaceful figures. And with wrathful, it's really an interesting thing, because you have, like, as I said, going back to India, you have really scary, kind of like almost demonic in a sense. Certainly the iconographic representation is demonic in a sense. I mean, you have, you know, people on flames and multiple heads wearing skull necklaces and this kind of stuff. And the thing is, you have to understand about this is that essentially there are two modes of enlightened activity. There's two kind of ways that we can approach this question of like, because at least in the Vajrayana understanding, Buddhism is active. Buddhism is like the Dharma is not just sort of some kind of passive realization. It's something that gets like when you're a part of being a Buddha, an essential part of being enlightened is performing enlightened activity. Of which, you know, there's kind of like, there's peaceful activity, you know, healing the sick, you know, things, you know, there's purifying. Also
it's also just the image of the Dharma as a sword that cuts through.
Right. Or like the sword of Manjushri, the flaming sword of Manjushri that cuts through the darkness of ignorance. And yeah, that's kind of metaphorical, but it's also kind of not. And there's one of the most important, very early wrathful Buddhist deities, so to speak, is a wrathful form of Manjushri, who's like very, very scary. His name is Yamantaka. You can look him up, we put him in the show notes. But yeah, I mean, he's like a very scary dude. And yes, you know,
actually, it was interesting because one of my first kind of exposures to Tibetan Buddhism was seeing an image of Yamantaka. And I was absolutely shocked. I'm like, they're worshiping this?
That's Buddhist, yeah, right. I thought Buddhism was like about flowers and shit.
No, and I, right. It actually inspired me to look into the whole wrathful deity practice and to understand what was going on.
Please go on.
Well, no, that's all I was going to comment on, the whole Yamantaka thing. There was, I guess, when we're trying to understand like the difference between like a peaceful enlightened activity versus wrathful enlightened activity. If I guess a lot of our listeners who might be from a Christian background are thinking with the life of Jesus. Yes, he brought Lazarus back from the dead. Yes, he would heal the sick. But he also drove the money changers out of the temple. And that's kind of the same embodiment of this action.
Absolutely. I had a Christian friend of mine who was, I was trying to explain enlightened activity to once, and how I, you know, sort of conceptualized Jesus. And I was like, well, look, Jesus healed the sick. There's four enlightened activities in Tibet world. There's like pacifying or healing or purifying. There's enriching or multiplying, you know, making abundance. There's magnetizing, drawing beings near you in a certain way, exercising power over their minds. But the point is having influence and drawing people close. And then there's like, yeah, essentially wrathful activity or a conquering activity, subjugating activity. And Jesus did all of these. You know, Jesus obviously was most famous in a way for healing the sick and you know, purifying people's illnesses and things like that. But he also, I mean, think of the loaves and the fishes, right? I mean, he had whatever, 5 loaves and 3 fishes or something. And he multiplied them until they fed a whole crowd of people. And then, you know, these cucked idiots will say like, oh, the real miracle is the sharing. No, idiot, the real miracle is that he enriched and multiplied very little sustenance into an enormous feast. And that's enriching activity. Yellow activity associated with, Ratnasambhava is like the Buddha at the head of the jewel or Ratna family. And then there's, you know, he magnetized his disciples, you know, that was some of his earliest activity was drawing people near to him. And just with the power of his presence and then, yeah, changing the, you know, I don't know that there's like another great example of that. Maybe, you know, some of the kind of ways that he dealt with the Pharisees, was certainly at least in an intellectual level, kind of BTFOing them would be, I think you could maybe consider that a kind of subjugating activity.
Well, depending on your form of Christianity too, there's the harrowing of hell too. There's like the,
definitely. Yeah. That's a great point.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, him driving the evil spirits out of that possessed man into the pigs and driving them
off
the cliff.
Yes, exactly. Yes, that's definitely also, yes. Anything having to do with basically conquering, subjugating, you know, removing, eliminating demons, liberating them into the basic space of Dharmata or whatever you want to put it, that's also in that, would typically fall under that category. So it's not like these concepts are alien to Christianity. It's just, and then of course you could say it like a kind of social, historical, political level, something like the Crusades, which were a defensive action to, you know, defend and reclaim territory that had been conquered by the sword of Islam. Like people nowadays it's very unpopular, but like, no, that's, you know, wrathful activity or subjugating activity in the defense of your society and your religion and the true faith. And there's nothing wrong with that. I guess the broader point I'm making is like you have to understand, first of all, everything comes down to motivation. And I think that's really the key here is, and this is why I keep harping on this, but it's really important. Your motivation needs to be, you know, maybe you're not Buddhist, you know, for those of you who are, your motivation needs to be bodhicitta, full stop. For those of you who aren't, you should still like look at, well, what is bodhicitta is the desire for all sentient beings to be free of suffering and the cause of suffering, to attain joy and equanimity beyond any kind of concept without any kind of limit. Okay, now that's a lot to ask. At the very least, if you're not Buddhist or you're not familiar with these ideas or whatever, no matter what you are, Christian or atheist or pagan, Bagang Gang, I don't care. If you're not, if your motivation is to hurt, to harm, like you need to be aware of that and you need to work on that. Because I guarantee you, I mean, if you really look, just spend some time looking at how it makes you feel to have that motivation, to have that in your heart, like see, and that doesn't mean that you have to give up on our political goals. That doesn't mean that you have to give up on anything that we do. It's really, the first step thing is just to see like, why am I doing this? What is really in my heart? Where is this really coming from?
Yeah, it's a cliche quote that gets tossed around, but it's a really good one about the, you know, the real warrior fights not because he hates what's in front of him, but because he loves what's behind him, right? Even when you're fighting, it needs to be out of a place of love.
And yeah, sorry, go on.
No, it's okay. You guys pause it. You know what? One thing that's what I was saying earlier about you know, all the ways in which anger can destroy a person if you hold it in your heart, and what our commentator, which by the way, shout out to a great handle there, Buddha Linkola, about holding on to the hot coal. You know, you think you're going to burn other people with it, but you're just burning yourself. It's one of the countless ways in which you know, modern clown world has messed everything up. Is they take, you know, there's this idea of you know, like overcoming hatred through love. And I actually do think that's the way it's done. I think that's the way it's taught in Buddhism. I think that's the way it's taught in Christianity too. And it's a sense of just being like a million times mightier than petty people. And that gets attached in our modern, when you're in public school, at least, or participating in any form of like globalized media or whatever, they hold up Gandhi and Martin Luther King as the examples of this. I don't have a comment right now on Gandhi per se, but you know, the MLK example is silly.
Apparently the Burmese have discovered his sex life, which has been very entertaining.
That got buried pretty quick. I mean, it's been buried forever, right?
But I was gonna say, I mean, it's not like news. It wasn't exactly, I guess it was sort of quasi confirmation of something.
I did not really know the thing about him laughing while watching.
No, that was being shot. Yeah,
let me get it out for anybody who hasn't heard this, with him laughing while watching a woman being raped by one of his friends. That's Martin Luther King. I didn't know that detail. Sorry to cut you guys off. But
No, I agree. I didn't know that detail. I think that was a new detail, but I mean, it didn't, I was sort of like, yeah, I mean, it fits the picture that I sort of, it wasn't.
Yeah. It's been well known in sort of edgy right-wing circles for a long time, but it's only now coming to to the knowledge of people outside of it.
Yeah. So, but anyway, even if, you know, let's say even if those people were as saintly as they're held up to be, it's still just, to me, I don't know, it's a sort of limiting thing, or it's tying this notion of overcoming hatred through love. It's tying it to a particular set of politics.
Well, I would even say it's tying it to a particular set of tactics, and that's the real problem. Like speaks to this ongoing Sohrab Ahmari David French thing, which I don't want to get into in too much detail, but I think it is relevant. For those, I mean, I guess maybe for posterity more, because presumably anyone listening to this at this moment in time is very well aware of what we're talking about. But for posterity, or for reference, there was an Iranian, I believe originally, was he Zoroastrian or Muslim? I believe he was Zoroastrian.
I think he was originally Muslim. Shia.
Anyway, there's this Iranian gentleman named Sohrab Ahmari who recently converted to Catholicism. And there is this, I don't want to get, YouTube just recently changed their policies. So there's a long string of invective that I would love to use, but I'm going to refrain. Let's just consider it all redacted, named David French. Basically, Sohrab Ahmari, who's, I think he knows a lot more than he lets on. He wrote a book recently also about essentially nationalism and immigration. And while, you know, he's a brown immigrant, he articulates things he's just correct in a lot of ways. I mean, he's clearly very perspicacious and understands, you know, what white people's grievances are and why they have them, and says basically, look, if we don't address these, there's going to be problems. And, you know, you can say, well, just exactly like with this David French debate, you know, he has the cultural space to be able to do that because he's a brown immigrant. That's true. At the same time, he's not wrong. And he's saying correct things. And one of the correct things in this context that he said, or the essence of this debate, is basically says, look, David French, you have conserved nothing. You are a useless burden. Your winsomeness and you're trying to attempt to be nice and polite and whatever has accomplished absolutely nothing in the political sphere. And then the French people will fight back and say, well, you know, but he's been winning court cases. And I don't care. It doesn't matter. Like, yeah, you won a couple court cases. So what? They're going to crush. There is a there was this Southern Baptist florist in Washington that's now going to face the like end of her business and just crushing debt because she wouldn't make flowers for a gay wedding. I mean, like, you can win individual court cases. It doesn't matter. The left doesn't care. And that's the point. These people do not respond the way that nice white people in a nice white Christian society respond. Like, you know, the reason Gandhi had traction and was the exact same reason that Martin Luther King, for all, whatever, had traction is because if you can create, even if it's like to some extent not, I mean, obviously we know that there's a media manipulation and all this kind of stuff. It doesn't matter. If you can create a situation where there's pictures of people who are unarmed walking down the street that are getting blasted by fire hoses, you know, it makes you look bad in a certain kind of society. It wouldn't make you look bad in Chinggis Khan society, but it makes you look bad in this society. And that's the problem is these people like David French are mentally incapable of realizing that the society that we live in now, quote unquote society, is much closer and moving even more close to something like Chinggis Khan society than to the nice white society of mid-century Euro-American Christendom. And that's the bottom line is the thing, like the reason why that those tactics worked, the reason why that kind of overcoming hate with love in that particular tactical mode worked is because the people who were hating you could be shamed into seeing what it is that they were doing. I submit that that's just not true. That is not true of the left. They are shameless. They are shameless liars and hypocrites and frauds. And everything starts from there. So and they are incapable of having any kind of, I mean, I don't mean like ontologically incapable. Obviously, they, you know, they have minds and minds work a certain way. But at the level of like a social movement, at the level of what's happening in a kind of macro scale, they just cannot see themselves for what they are, which is demons, as we've discussed. So like there's this whole thing about like, oh, I'm just going to be like Martin Luther King and, you know, I'm going to meekly submit and turn the other cheek, which isn't even what turn the other cheek means. We can get into that later. You know, that's just not going to work because they're just going to slap you with one cheek and then slap you with the other cheek and then stab you through the heart and laugh because yeah. That's who they are.
It worked very well in 1960s America, and it worked in 1940s India under the British Raj. But how did it work for the Chinese students in 1989?
Exactly.
How would it work for Tibetans today in China?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. But I still think though that at least for me, that is the useful way to think about how when you have righteous indignation or a sense of injustice, when you want to practice the Dharma with wrathful compassion. Or any other way you want to phrase it, how to frame it in my mind is indeed to think of anger or pettiness, you know, resentment or what Nietzsche would call, you know, ressentiment, right? That smoldering, holding that red hot fire of anger, right? It is that it can feel good, and this is in the sutras too, actually, that you get this little mini pleasure. From anger, but then you just burn yourself. So because it does have this little mini pleasure to it, getting angry does sort of feel good on one particular level. The way to overcome that is to reframe it in your mind that you're going to rise above that. You're going to become 1,000 times bigger than that. And then in that sense, love absolutely is like the way to overcome hatred. It is actually the way to overcome your enemies. But again, not in this way that we're just describing, which A is put up falsely and B is a tactic. I think that's a good way of putting it, Dharmakirti. And C, you know, only works in certain contexts, you know, and with the enemies that we're dealing with today it's not going to work. I think you put that very, very well. Yeah, I'll leave it at that. The Buddha actually, there's some, I'll have some more quotes, but I'll wait to get into them.
When you're talking about reframing a thing about anger as a thing about love, one thing that does actually come to mind is, like has been mentioned, it's very easy when people come on and say, oh, I hate white people and I hate white men and straight white men need to be taken out of power and whatnot. It's very easy to have hatred towards that person. But it also seems very easy to reframe that hatred as a kind of compassion. For instance, it's not because one hates this person, but because one loves the cultural products of Western civilization. I like, say, the artistic history of Western civilization, the literary tradition of Western civilization, the moral foundation of Western civilization, something like that. And because, and when you're acting out of love for a particular thing, that makes it a lot more healthy, I would think.
No, I completely agree. I don't know. In a sense, I don't have much to add to that. That's, I think, very well said. Yeah, we have to be concerned. Look, tearing. That's not even 100. I was going to say tearing things down isn't going to help. That's actually not true. This clown world needs to be torn down.
Depends, right. Yeah, depends on what we're tearing down.
It's not because we hate the people who make up clown
right.
world. It's because
that's right.
What they're going to create is a horror show that will harm countless living
that's
beings.
Right. That's right. That's
so
exactly right.
It's not that I hate immigrants at all. I mean, but do I dislike the idea of thousands of people every year overdosing on opiates or committing suicide because they have a society that's completely forgotten about their needs? That's
yeah. Yeah. It's like we talked about on the compassion. This is like idiot compassion, right?
Yes.
There's this kind of idiotic compassion that I actually think, I mean, there's several different tiers of this. There's a one tier that's like the cat lady wine aunt that they're just idiots. There's another layer that it's like, which is some overlap, but I think it's kind of a distinct phenomenon, which is, you know, it's malicious. It's I hate these things, but I, you know, talking about it in this culturally acceptable way about, you know, love and tolerance and whatever, we're just removing hatred. It gives me a way to indulge in my violent fantasies and in my violent behavior, you know, throwing milkshakes, throwing rocks, throwing eggs, beating people up, slapping them in the face, hitting them with bike locks, all the things that we've seen Antifa do on video. It provides a kind of culturally, socially acceptable way for me to engage in violent behavior. It doesn't have to rise to that level. I think most people that I know that fit into that, and I think of a few people in particular in my life, it's not even, it's just that they, you know, they have self-loathing, they have self-hatred. These are white people, by the way, not Gentile whites, who have imbibed this cultural message, and they hate themselves and they hate their history and they hate their families. And so what they do is they sublimate it into like this kind of extreme left-wing politics. And there's a very easy to detect, if you know what to look for, just hate, you know, hatred really, but it sort of gets masked in like this language about love and tolerance and diversity and all that bullshit. So the question is, you know, okay, yeah, what do you do when you're confronted with that? And I don't, as I've said repeatedly, it's not that we just sort of sit there and take it, but then what does it mean to respond in an effective way, in a loving way, but in a way that is not at all cuckolded? And I have maybe some ideas, but they're not super well formed. And I'm curious what you all have to say.
Well, I'm actually remembering there was a Buddhist monk in Tibet before Buddhism was established in the country. And there was a king, and I can't remember the name of either of these two people, who was persecuting Buddhism because he was attached to the Bon religion.
Lang Dharma, it was the name of the king.
Yeah.
Yep. Go on.
And the monk assassinated that king and then ran off and hid, basically. And this was seen as a good thing, to eliminate someone who was persecuting the Dharma.
Yeah, yeah, it was. I mean, that's sort of historiographically how that
it was good in Minecraft.
Yeah, exactly, right. Yes, only we're very yes. Just to be clear, there's not a, don't do anything. We're not endorsing, and I could put on my kind of, you know, history. We'd say like, oh well, you know, this is how the Tibetans would represent. You know, the Buddhists would say this about. I mean, obviously, the Buns have a very different version of this story. It's, you know, the question of, well, or I'm curious, what do you first? I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot.
I wish Storm King were here, first of all, because I love Storm King and I enjoy his company, but also because I'm about to say some quote unquote cheesy or cringe stuff, and I need my inner Storm King here to tell me. Don't give in to that cringe.
Yeah, you just posted cringe, bro.
Yeah, I need him to tell me. Don't listen to that voice inside you. Go ahead and speak your truth, baby. So that's what I'm gonna do. I think the first thing to do is to live it, is to live that love, is to radiate it from yourself as much as you can, to truly actually feel peace. And that starts in the morning, that starts with your, that starts with meditation, that starts with contemplating the Dharma, contemplating the divine, for people who aren't Buddhists, and to really seek happiness for yourself in the most basic ways, which is to just let there be happiness inside of you when you're out in the world. And that is the first defense. That is the first defense against anger and against acting in stupid ways, because people act stupid and hateful out of inner weakness. Okay, somebody who's totally secure in what they're doing is not affected on an emotional level by those things. Now, none of us are perfect, and none of us are Buddhas yet. But of course you're going to have times when you
speak for yourself, man. No,
right on, brother. Right on. I love it. So of course there's going to be times when you don't live up to that totally, and you know, we all have bad days, and you know, so go easy on yourself on that. But in general, that should be the main goal. That should be the goal, is to be happy yourself and to spread happiness to others through not only your example, but your actions, your words, your face. Like, this is why the quote I read at the very beginning about, you know, anger makes people ugly. If I had read the expanded version of the quote, he says something like, you know, you can have the nicest clothes and you can anoint your beard with oils and all these things, you know, all these old timey Indian things. And it says, and yet your face will be ugly if you're full of anger. And I really do believe that to be true.
Oh, it's 100%. I mean, you can see it. You see how it twists people's faces up, and you see how, like, yes. I mean, the same way that, yes. You know, dirty living and alcohol over a long period of time messes people's faces up. You can see it in people. You know, if you're just angry all the time, it will change your face. You can see it. It's 100% real.
And so, and what's the gentleman? What's the great Tibetan master that you posted in our picture?
Jamyang Khensei Chukyi Ludro, who's like we could put some bio information. He's just a really important
I want you to talk about him, but I just wanted his name for now, because that picture you posted, that is the picture of a happy person. Like, and he's not a goofy happy. He's not but there is a radiance coming. And that's an old photograph digitized and sent through the internet. And I can feel the peace and wisdom and happiness coming out of that face. And it's not because he's beautiful, you know, like sexy or anything like that. He's just, there is happiness in that person. I can see it. And people can see that and feel it in real life. So the first thing is that. And the second thing is to look at people with compassion. Not to be too simplistic about it, but again, I think Storm King would tell me, just go ahead and say it. To see the suffering, to see that when people are full of hate, anger, and rage, even when it's directed at you and your loved ones, it's only because they're unhappy. And many times you're in situations where it's not possible to deflect that through love. You know, you just need to defend yourself, or you just need to get away from that person sometimes is the best thing. And not interact with them until, you know, the time is right. But there are many times in which people just are sort of dwelling and you know, just sort of stuck in their own little mind traps on some political issue, even that they're not even necessarily that married to yet. And you can actually, just through like being nice to them in a genuine way, not in a condescending way. But you know, like if somebody had just had a wonderful warm hug from his or her loved one, you know, his wife or her husband or something, they're filled with this warmth and love, and they don't have it in them at that moment to be spiteful and hateful and angry and everything. Now, a lot of these people don't have loved ones or anything, you know, and that's part of the reason maybe that they feel this way.
Go on.
The point is that you, in many small ways throughout the day with everybody you deal with, you can provide that for them in a loving and compassionate way. And it feels good to do it. That's the great thing. It's like, it doesn't cost you anything. The person who benefits the most from it is actually yourself. And so anyway, it also goes for interacting online. It goes with it. I guess I'm going to start repeating myself right now, but that's, I guess, the really, really core thing. And I, I guess it doesn't lead to great political discussion or anything, but I really do honestly think that's the way. I do think that's how we win. I really do.
Well, yeah. I mean, I had this pulled up. I was maybe going to say, maybe we can repeat, but it's funny. When I first heard it at the end of Tedious, I was like, wait, really? This is the quote you're going? I mean, it made me think higher of them. But, you know, in the end, every episode with the quote from Richard Nixon, you know, remember, always give your best. Never get discouraged. Never be petty. Always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them. And then you destroy yourself. That's extremely wise words. Those are extremely wise words. And it's, I think, again, a credit to those guys.
Correct.
That they make sure to end the show with that, because it's true. It's true. And it's very important. It's something we need to keep in mind. And yeah, you know, this, I think about this, how to say, I'm not a believer. I've always, my whole life, I've rejected this idea that, you know, the truth is in the middle necessarily. It can be, it often is, but the middle, you know, the middle can cover, you know, a lot of ground between one side and another. And second, sometimes one side is just right. And third of all, you know, specifically when it comes to negative interactions between people, like, sure, there are plenty of cases where it's just too, like, thugs or whatever, to people with bad motivations and a lot of anger and hate just kind of going at each other. That definitely happens. But it also happens that even if one person isn't like 100% great, you know, like, oftentimes there is a clear kind of aggressor or wrongdoer, someone who's in the wrong more so than the other person, right?
Sure.
And so that creates a situation, a dynamic where it's like, let's say, I mean, because I've been in this situation, you know, sometimes, one time recently that I'm thinking about, I may talk about more in a second, but where, you know, essentially there is this kind of angry person or aggressor who's like coming at you. And okay, you know, on the one hand, there's an extent to which, exactly as you said, you need to defend yourself. And at a kind of basic level, you know, especially your physical safety needs to be taken care of. But then if that's not necessarily directly an issue at the stake at the moment, at a certain level, and I really hesitate to say this because I think it can very easily tip into this kind of just bullshit platitudes, you know, hippies like to repeat. But it really is true. If so much, the key point that we need to be really clear on and distinguish, which is extremely hard in the moment. And if you can do it, that's great. If not, then try to at least maybe do it afterwards if you're ever in the situation and like notice, okay, what did I do? Why did I do it? How did this happen? Why did I react this way? And so on. Just to try to notice that's the key point. But in any case, when you feel defensive, when you feel like you're being attacked, when you feel like you're being exposed, especially when it's unfair and it's unjust, right? That's your ego. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean, like, we all have egos. We're not, you know, speaking for myself, we're all, you know, sentient beings here. We're not enlightened. Okay, fine. But like, so it's not a bad thing, but you got to be clear, like, okay, where is this coming? Where's this feeling of defensiveness and exposure and like, oh my God, I'm being attacked for like completely unjust reasons. Like, it's not to say that you shouldn't respond. It's not even to say that you shouldn't respond aggressively. It's to say you have to recognize that's coming from my ego. And what I've noticed, and I encourage everyone to try this at home, but I mean, it's not coming from me. It's something that I heard. And, you know, I thought about, and then I tried to put it into practice, and I've noticed that I think it's correct, is when you're being attacked. Like, I had a, I don't want to say too much for a variety of reasons, but there was let's say a Dharma brother who came to me with a Dharma question, essentially. And he sort of wanted clarification on something. And so I started clarifying it for him, and he instantly became extremely angry and extremely defensive and started talking about how I didn't know anything and all of this stuff. And it was very, I mean, I actually talked about it later with a kind of senior teacher, although I was like, and I, you know, I was sort of like, well, this person was saying this, and I didn't really, you know, I wanted to make sure that I was not completely deluded myself. The teacher was like, no, you were completely right. But his question was like, how did you respond? And I'm like, well, you know, I tried to just sort of defuse the situation. And he's like, yeah, that's the correct approach, because when you react aggressively, right, unless it's sort of in a very, like, it's not just about that moment. I think that's something that we need to keep in mind. You know, there can be benefits to reacting aggressively, and it's not something that we should never do. But But part of what it means to be wise, I think a very important part of what it means to be wise, and we should all be aspiring to be more wise, is to understand that there are consequences that ramify beyond the present moment, and that all of these things, you know, have effects that reach far into the future. And so when we, you know, unless we have a kind of that kind of panoramic perspective, like it can be hard to understand how these things are going to affect ourselves and others in the future. And particularly when it comes to this, you know, very delicate political and social moment, you know, it's not to say you shouldn't defend yourself. It's not even to say you shouldn't, you know, defend yourself aggressively, but we have to be clear on, you know, is this really the right course of action at this particular moment? And why? Where is this coming from within myself? I know I'm repeating myself, but I think it's just something that needs to be.
No, it's a really good point. It's a really good, really strong point, man. There's a little story from the sutras where one of the like servants of some king left him and went to become a monk under the Buddha. And so this king became, or, you know, local lord or whatever, became angry, went to the Buddha and was like just a tirade of angry, harsh words at the Buddha. And the Buddha's response, by the way, you guys ever
get I love it. I know this sutra. I love this sutra. Sorry, go on. By the way, what?
Sometimes I was about to say the obvious and say to wish that I could have met the Buddha. That's true for many, many, many reasons, of course. But there is this almost like sometimes it's not smug. What's the word I'm looking for? With people who are really like angry in the sutras or really just deluded or whatever, the way the Buddha responds sometimes is so funny to me because it's so like... Am I talking out of turn here? Like, do you guys know what I'm talking about?
I get what you're saying. We often sort of mythologize it. And particularly in the Mahayana, I think we sort of like, you know, the Buddha basically becomes this kind of incomprehensible god. But yeah, I mean, if anyone who's interacting.
Pretty funny sometimes.
Yeah. It's.
And there's a way that Socrates does it in Plato that's like annoying sometimes. I'm like, oh, shut up, Socrates. You know, like, but I don't know. Maybe it's because of my prior biases, but the way that Buddha does it, at least the way it's reported in the sutras, I'm always like, like, it's funny to me. Anyway, so this sutra, very, very briefly, he's coming at the Buddha and he's saying all these bad things to him and angry. And the Buddha's like, my friend, you know, when guests come to visit you at your palace or whatever, do you offer them food and everything and nice things to eat? And he's like, well, yes. And he says, and if they decline the nice food and everything, to whom does that food belong? And the king's like, well, then it belongs to me. He's like, well, likewise, when you offer all of these like harsh words and everything to me and all this hate and everything, I just decline to accept it.
Yeah.
So
just brilliant.
So I mean, So to whom would you say that belongs now? You know, like, it belongs to you,
just
buddy.
Pulling the pants off this guy. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but in like the most kind, gentle. Yeah, that's how we want to aspire to be. And it's really tough. I mean, and again, because this is the kind of thing I'm talking about. That then becomes not just like in that moment, because you got, okay, put yourself in that moment. In that moment, like, because the Buddha's surrounded by disciples and like they're seeing like, okay, so how's he going to react? Well, he reacts. He just doesn't. He's like, there's nothing even. And that's, of course, what it means to be Buddha. Ultimately, is you just, there's nothing even there to attack. There's nothing like you're you know, trying to stab at a shadow. There's just absolutely nothing. It's like, what are you even doing, man? But in terms of how it appears to other sentient beings, it's like, okay, that then becomes a story, an instructive story, a funny story, something that we repeat thousands of years later. Like, oh wow, you know. Someone came and did all that. This was just like laying into him and just speaking so nasty and cursing him out. And now we're like laughing about it 2,500 years later about like, see, this is what you can do. And then if you do it in this way with that level of wisdom and that level of insight and that level of compassion, then you become a model for people. Because I mean, again, put yourself in the Brahmin's shoes. You know, could you imagine like you go to someone and you're like, you fucking motherfucker, piece of shit, blah, 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 blah. And then they just sort of, de-pants you in this such a just like thorough but also gentle way, like, you know, and then you just feel embarrassed. You're like, oh, I guess I'll go home now. Like the whole thing is just collapses. It's diffused. And what a powerful lesson, right? And that, I mean, again, okay, that's the Buddha. We're not there yet, but we can sort of model that. We can approach that, and that is the most effective kind of thing you can do.
I heard you take a breath, Kagyu.
I'm actually kind of reminded for a minute. Initially, Devadatta, who I'm sure you're familiar with that whole story, how he tried several times to kill the Buddha after being refused, like some kind of, I think it was like he was refused a leadership position of some sort in the Sangha, and the Buddha compared him to spittle, if I recall correctly. And the Buddha's reaction was not of anger. It was just kind of a very nonplussed, I guess is the best term for it. He knew what was going on, but there was no like aggressively angry reaction whatsoever, just a sort of awareness of it. And he knew what was going to happen. And eventually, I guess the end is he's dragged off to, Devadatta was dragged off to the hell realms. And he just knew.
I think there's very, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, maybe. I don't know what the, I don't, I'm actually unfamiliar with stories about Devadatta's ultimate fate. I don't know. Yeah, but it is true. He was like, he's kind of the archetypical, like bad Buddha. Like this is like the model for bad behavior. Like if you're acting like Devadatta, like there's something wrong with you and you need to cool it.
Well, yeah, I mean, like the five, some of the five sins that are guaranteed to give you rebirth in the lowest level of the hell realms in the next, I mean, trying to kill, killing an arhat, drawing blood from an enlightened being, or trying to create a schism in the Sangha. It's three of the five at least.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's actually a good point. Yes, that's absolutely true. But anyway,
another way to phrase this is and again, it's so important to, you know, to be doing it with good humor and with a sense of expansiveness and everything, to not become condescending, but to use the example of, you know, when a little child is acting out or something, you know, generally you don't get angry. You know what I mean? I mean, sometimes what's needed is, you know, stern words or something, but you don't like lose your cool, or you shouldn't, at least with a 3-year-old, for example. And the more peaceful you are, and the more sort of wise and enlightened and happy, I would say, that you are, the more sort of bad behavior you can tolerate while still, you know, while still acting in a, maybe sometimes a stern way or whatever. And, again, what I was saying about, like, if you meet people who are being sort of like, to take it back to political stuff, you know, there's some people who are like determined foes. And maybe if I were Buddha, I'd be able to like dispel that or whatever, but I'm not there yet. But a lot of people really aren't they aren't as committed as they think they are. Let me just put it this way. When we did our first show, we gave our background stories and everything, and I gave a sort of self-deprecating, slightly humorous, I don't know how humorous it was, but it was self-deprecating talking about, oh, I was a college Marxist and everything, but I was sort of eliding over like some of the real, you know, I don't think I was ever a really spiteful or hateful person, because frankly, I was pretty happy in general, but I was very committed to some pretty ugly ideas at one point in my life that I now look back on with a bit of shame, to be honest. I don't dwell on it. I don't beat myself up over it, but I do regret, you know, some of my past positions and stuff, but I changed, right? I changed. And I'm sure there are things that I hold now or, you know, resentments or angers that I carry around in my heart today that, you know, with blessings and with, you know, practice and everything, that I can hopefully clear out of my heart so that 10 years from now I look back and say, well, I'm more peaceful than I was then. So it is possible, and not only possible, but very frequent, that people do actually change their minds. So just because somebody's like your political opponent on a particular issue and they're arguing with about it, like, even though we just had our last episode on demons and talked about how serious the real threats are and everything, if you guys recall that episode, I was at pains to sort of say, you know, there's also just this low level stuff that is really bad in aggregate, but each individual person isn't really that bad. You know what I mean? And so I think it's important to keep that in mind and not have too much spite and disdain for any one individual Bugman. But while maintaining your disdain for Bugmanism in general, for example.
Yeah, I mean, love the sinner, hate the sin is also, I think, good advice and a profound message, something we should keep in mind. And I kind of see it that way. And it's like, this is a good point that that Mike Enoch has been making recently is, you know, at an individual level, you know, we're all responsible, and you can sort of say like people, you know, make bad choices, et cetera, et cetera. But what, you know, you can't see, and I think that, you know, there's a kind of cheesy way people often talk about dependent origination. Maybe we can have a future episode on it, although it's kind of a tough topic to talk about in certain ways. But anyway, you know, part of what it means to say that all phenomena are interrelated and dependently originated is precisely to say that people don't make choices in a vacuum, and people don't live their lives in a vacuum, and, you know, people respond to the incentives that are put before them and the disincentives that are put before them. So, yeah, I mean, it's not, you could say like any individual bug man, you know, is, it's not that to say that what they're doing is okay, but this is they're products of the cult. This took like a long time for me. Cause I think a lot like you, I was sort of like a kind of left libertarian ish kind of, you know, guy for a while. And then I started thinking about things as you get older, you start thinking about things differently, of course. And what I realized was, you know, people are very much products of their society and their culture. I mean, you have, obviously, you're always going to have kind of outliers. Typically, you know, often the kind of smarter people are going to be outliers. But even then, it's like, you know, most people are just, you know, going to be, to a very large extent, products of their environment. And so, you know, it doesn't really help us to like, to hate on any individual, to sort of be like, to just be like, oh, this person is, you know, it's like the inverse of Naxalt, right? It's like, it's true that not all X are like that, but that doesn't actually even matter, because systemically X's tend to be a certain way. Well, just by the same, like, okay, well, why? Right. And unless you start addressing things at that level, you're never going to get anywhere, and you're never going to get anywhere by sort of saying, you know, yes, you know, bug men are a problem, but it doesn't, you know, if you see some bug man, it's just like, this is the kind of thing. And I think it gets back to like issues that like Borzoi and people talk about, you know, it's, you see the guy with the Star Wars trailer, right? And we all did our kind of 2 minutes mockery of the guy with the Star Wars, you know, this guy who saw the trailer for the new Star Wars shit, and he was like crying or whatever. And it's funny. I mean, I laughed. I saw the thing. I was like, what the fuck? I participated in that.
I honestly thought that it was a joke at first.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, yeah, right. Yeah, because it's so ludicrous. But the key, I think what I'm saying is, you know, it doesn't help. Like, what is it really? At a certain level, you can say, okay, well, we can hold him up as a kind of like a symbol of, you know, he is kind of this condensed version of, you know, what is happening in Bugman world. But like making fun of him, or think, you know, particularly, or even at that level of like, you know, he's a kind of way to talk about or think about bugmen in general. You know, it doesn't really, what does it really gain us? Right. What is it? I mean, you know, at a certain level, it gains us a way to talk about or think about stuff, but really that's not why people are doing it. They're doing it because they think they're superior. I did it because I thought I was superior. You know, he's caught in this thing, and that doesn't help me. That just doesn't help me.
Well, I think a lot of bug men, like you said, they're essentially a product of the culture they're from. They're responding to the incentives they're from. They are the way they are today because they get marketing messages that push them towards this kind of apathetic approach towards religion, with consumer culture replacing it. So you have your brunch and your craft beer, and this is your Sunday activity now. If there was a different system in place, they wouldn't be bug men. They would be responding to it. It's just like, basically, throw them in a river and they'll float in whatever direction the current takes them.
And that's why it's so important that we take back power, right? Yes. Because when we have power, then we can create, then we make a system that is in line with reality, that creates incentives that are healthy, that lead people towards happiness and enlightenment and salvation, rather than whatever the fuck we're heading towards now.
It's like Saurabh Amari was saying. It's, I mean, yes, today you see Roe v. Wade might have a slight majority of support, but if you reversed it and you took back power, you'd suddenly see a lot of people change their minds, because that's what happens.
Yes. We have a great question from some in the chat, Tim Kane, which I think is funny, but he says, do you have compassion for the bug men? I mean, I think we all do. I'm maybe speaking for everyone here, and I'm curious to hear other people's thoughts. But yeah, of course I have. I have compassion. I mean, I said this in a previous episode. I'll say this again. And I was getting some pushback from Gay Tetsuo on Twitter, who's a kind of interesting gad. I mean, I like him, and he's a Pure Land guy. I think Jodo Shinshu and a kind of a gadfly in certain ways, which is fine. I like that. I'm a gadfly myself on occasion. But you know, he was saying like, oh, do you think it's compatible with Buddhism to like be dunking on like, you know, the Jews and the blacks and blah 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 all the time? I'm like, first of all, I don't look at it that way. But beyond that, it's like, yeah, I try to conclude. I mean, I typically succeed in remembering whenever I'm doing a, you know, daily practice session, whenever, like, I make a specific point out of the people that I consider my political opponents and enemies, and the people, even particularly the people that bear me and my family and my people, my ethnos, my race, ill will, right? I make a particular point out of dedicating my merit that I've accumulated and the roots of my merit, whatever virtue I've managed to, like, not just like good things that I've done, but to whatever extent I've managed within myself to reorient my selfish impulses into good impulses. Those are called the roots of virtue. And to dedicate not just the merit that we accomplish, not just the virtue, but the roots of virtue, dedicate that to our enemies. That's what I try to do every day. And I'm not saying that I'm good at it. Sorry, go on. Yeah.
I would say that intellectually, yes, I absolutely have compassion for the Bugmen. I think that something I need to do better is being more active with it. And, you know, part of the problem, of course, is if you get snippets through Twitter or whatever, or through social media or the internet in general, like, for example, this guy, the Star Wars crying guy or whatever, you know, if that's what you see of somebody, you're like, oh, my God, you know, like, just... Oh, this is embarrassing. How can you call yourself a grown man? You know, and you know, like you're saying, you know, people just dunking on him, you know, left and right. That's very easy to do, especially because you don't see. I will note actually something interesting. I don't even remember what it was, but the next day that guy was making fun of himself in a very public way. And
oh, I didn't see that. That's funny.
Yeah, yeah, and I wish I could remember exactly what he did, but he obviously had realized that many people thought it was totally absurd and mockable and everything. And he made it known. He's like, yeah, I see your point. That is pretty dumb. Like, and it immediately humanized him, of course, you know. I still think he's ridiculous for doing that and should, you know, reexamine some of his priorities or whatever, but whatever, it's his life, not mine. And when it is possible to humanize people like that. And just, so in daily life away from the internet, just walking in the street, interacting with people or whatever, it is absolutely a goal of mine to have compassion for all sentient beings, but that has to start with the ones you actually encounter. So I also yes. dedicate my merit on the pillow, Dharmakirti, and it often feels very abstract. I'm just speaking from my own experience. Like,
sure.
It's something I've been taught to go through, and I do go through it, and I see the point. And sometimes I actually feel something really interesting from that and something very good and positive. But a lot of times it's just an abstraction, right? The real test is to go out into life and to see the divine nature and to see the Buddha nature of every person you interact with, even the worst of the worst, and to have compassion for them as sentient beings. Everybody wants to be happy. Every single being desires happiness.
Desperately.
Yep.
Desperately desires happiness.
That's right.
And it's like I was saying earlier, I mean, with the Bugman, it's somewhat, when you understand the Bugman is a symptom of the culture we live in and is really just reacting to the stimuli they're receiving, to the cultural programming they're receiving, it's a lot easier to have compassion for them. And I certainly do, because I understand, you know, if they had been born 50 or 100 years before, they probably wouldn't be Bugmen. And so in that respect, yes, I do have compassion for them.
Okay. Well, I don't know that I have a whole lot more to add. Do you guys have more you want to say?
No, except that I really enjoy having these talks because it's a great way to clarify what's going on in my own head. You know, I think we said this before we started recording that I said, oh, I've got this little spiel I could say at the beginning, but then I don't know what else I'm going to say. And, you know, questions like that from
from Tim Kaine, from Governor Tim Kaine there, or was he a senator? He's a governor, right?
Anyway, I think he was I think he was both. I think he was a governor and became a senator or something. Yeah, anyway, yeah.
Well, now he's a YouTube questioner, so it's good. questions like that are really good because they make you stop and respond. And then, you know, if you're being honest with yourself, then you start questioning your response maybe a little bit and trying to clarify it. So I find these talks really helpful for me. Yeah.
I do as well. I mean, it is rare to have an honest and uncensored conversation these days, especially and within Buddhism, where of course the culture tends to be pretty hard to the left, so it requires a lot of careful words and self-censorship. So that's always very nice.
Yeah. The only thing I guess I wanted to add was one real quick, as we're maybe concluding as a kind of note on that, is definitely it can be abstract in my experience. And as I'm talking through it, I'm noticing, you know, maybe it can be even a bit abstract for me in the sense of thinking about things kind of, you know, dedicating to groups without necessarily thinking about any particular individual, which is a problem. It could kind of, you know, this telescope. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Point is, in my experience, just, you know, throwing it out there, is dedicating merit in that sense to me is often like just the best part of practice. It really, to me, is like, is where I feel everything kind of like that moment of peace, that moment of tranquility, that moment of joy. Yeah, please go on.
Can I ask you, what does that look like? Like, technically speaking, what do you do? And when, at the end of your sit or what?
Yeah, at the end of a formal session, typically. So typically, there's Buddhist practice is structured with beginning, middle, and end. And the beginning is what's called taking refuge, which is what I put at the sound at the beginning of every episode that we put on the RSS feed for download. Is I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. Maybe we could talk about this a little more at some time in an episode, but it's basically saying, you know, I'm in this karmic situation where I'm kind of lost without a guide, but there is a guide. It's the Buddha, and there's taught the way out. That's the teaching, and there's people that I need, you know, I can talk with and have a community with that can help, and that's the Sangha. And so I go for refuge in these three jewels. And then you do whatever it is you're doing, meditation, you know, breathing, or sadhana practice, you know, visualizing yourself as a deity, or whatever it is that you're doing. That's the main part, and, you know, obviously the most of it. And then at the end, there's what's called dedicating merit, which is this idea that there's a kind of common teaching where if because practicing meditation and so on is very, very virtuous. It's like the most virtuous thing you can do, really. But that virtue can go away. It can be actually lost or destroyed. They say a single moment of anger can destroy eons of virtue. So the way that you prevent that from happening, the way you prevent it from deteriorating and from being lost, is you say, okay, rather than keep this for myself or just sort of let it go up, but then maybe go down, is I'm going to take that. And in my experience, it's like the more that you think of it in a very real way, the more you think of it in a way that's like I'm actually doing, you have to really believe. And it's true. I mean, I would defend that this actually is happening. And you say like, okay, well, I did this thing. It's really virtuous, or to whatever extent, maybe you like, you know, especially when you're starting or even not, you know, sometimes I just have, you know, I'm like, I didn't do much. It was, you know, 3 minutes or something. But even so, it's an incremental step. It's a step in the right direction. And that is important. It's a step in the right direction. You say, okay, this good step that I took, I'm not going to keep it for myself. I'm going to dedicate it. I'm going to say, rather than just keeping this as like something that's going to benefit me, I want this to benefit all sentient beings. And you generate this motivation of, I take this thing that I did that's good, but I don't want it to, the good results of that to just be me. I mean, the good results, I want it absolutely everyone throughout time and space. And I find it helpful coming out of, you know, the Tibetan thing. I visualize that as rainbow light, which I guess now in redacted month is, you know, reclaiming, reclaiming the rainbow.
Heck yeah, man.
And be like, look, okay, this is rainbow light that is touching all sentient beings everywhere. This like this virtue is like with rainbow light, and it's showing absolutely everywhere, and purifying their illnesses and their obscurations, and bringing them close one little incremental step closer to enlightenment. Because there is power in what I've done, and that power is now touching everyone. That's how I look at it.
it's incredibly affirmative. You know, it's, as I said,
when I do that, it's like, I mean, especially when I do it well, and I've done it, which I find is usually when I'm not too worried about whether I'm doing it well or not. But right. You know, it, there's nothing that compares to like the sensation of, you know, when you feel like, okay, I've now dedicated that. I mean, it's just, I suggest everyone try it. You don't have to like quote unquote be Buddhist to do that. And I think, you know, you may be surprised by what you find.
I go through a bit of a rote thing at the beginning of all my formal sits. And it's, I say rote because sometimes it feels very rote and I just force myself to go through it because this is the commitment that I've made and what I've been taught. But often it's not rote. Often it's incredibly liberating. One of the main things that can get in the way of concentration meditation is resentment, is anger, in fact, right? People, you know, lust is another example of one of the hindrances, but generally that doesn't tend to come up so much when you're sitting, at least when I'm sitting, that's not so much of a problem. But if you are sitting there stewing over something, it can really get in the way of things. And one antidote to that, this isn't the only reason to do that, but that's one of the reasons given to do it. The antidote is you sit down and you say, may I have happiness and the causes of happiness? May I be free from suffering and the causes of suffering? And then just expand the circle outwards to people that you find easy to love, which is family usually, but although that can be very problematic for some people, if you know, because a lot of times family can be a source of a lot of, you know.
Well, I mean, fucking Freudian shit just fucked everybody's shit up, fam.
No kidding. You know. But I do it anyway. And actually, you know, I don't have a, you know, it's not like I've never had problems with members of my family, but it's pretty easy when you practice this, it's pretty easy to be like, wow, I really actually love these people and I'm so grateful to them for everything, you know? And then you can expand it out. I expand it out to friends or like, if you know, I travel a lot and I think about the people in the community that I'm currently a guest in. And I thank them and then I expand it outwards to sort of, you know, like maybe everybody on this continent be happy. And then maybe everybody on this planet and then everybody, all beings throughout time and space have happiness and the causes of happiness and be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. And like I said, sometimes it's very rote when I do it. I don't have a lot of feeling behind it. Other times when I do that, I'm like, wow, I actually really want this. Yeah. I really want this, you know? And it's such a good feeling because A, I feel like I'm helping just whatever tiny little bit that I can. I'm helping by sending that intention out. And also, again, not to be, you know, so selfish about things, but it's a good kind of selfishness. Also, you know, you feel this lifting of your own spirit because you can recognize the goodness in yourself as somebody who in your practice, Dharmakirti, who's sending out rainbow energy of light, even if it was a tiny bit of merit you generated or a lot of merit. It
doesn't matter. The point is that it doesn't matter. But sorry, go on.
Yes, exactly. But it's also then you can look back on yourself, and I know this isn't the point, but it happens anyway, at least in my experience. You're like, yeah, I am the kind of person who dedicates merit to other people. And you can reframe, because it's easy to get down on yourself in life sometimes. And it's good to remember that, like, I am generating merit, and I can help other people. I can do this. And then it's easier to also translate into, like, more mundane and, you know, practically measurable things in, you know, in terms of being generous with your time, your energy, et cetera, and being loving in day-to-day life when you sort of formalize it in your religious practice too. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense. And I think it's a great place to end. Kagi, do you have any final closing thoughts?
Well, I mean, what does seem interesting to I had been under the impression that dedication of merit was very specifically a Mahayana practice, but that's because the goal with Mahayana is to assist all living beings in gaining enlightenment. That's the end goal. And so when you're dedicating merit, you're kind of pushing it in that correct direction. And that's at least my understanding for why that's done.
I think it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, that's a whole thing there. We could maybe talk about it another time. Yes. But yeah, I think it's not just Mahayana, it's everyone. And it's really, really important. And I think it's
DK has to dedicate some of his love and attention to another being right now.
Yeah, he's somebody just woke up from his nappy. So I'm going to take it from my family circle first and catch you all later. Yeah. Thank everyone so much for participating. And thank you, Aura and Kagyu. Hope to see everybody next week. Goodbye.
Peace.
Goodbye.